Technology, and the first order of business is an informational meeting on scenic project, and so if Director Ball and Mr. Ryer would come forward, we'd appreciate it. I'm going to open the meeting. Thank you for coming, and I really appreciate you making yourselves available to do this, to update some of the new members on information technology. So whenever you're ready, go ahead.
Chair Riley, members of the committee, my name is Lindsey Ball. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Administrative Services. I think the best place to start to give you an overview is the concept behind the State Data Center, the Scenic Project, which is now most commonly referred to as the State Data Center, was how can we take 12 data centers in 12 specific agencies, consolidate those into one center, and save cost for the state of Oregon. That was the concept behind the Scenic Project. That was the motivation. On the outward side, as it was, supported in the newspapers, the media, and also the halls of this building, a money-saving venture. But I think we also need to look at other efficiencies associated with a data center, too. And I think the greatest motivation that should be looked upon the Scenic Project or the State Data Center was one of security for the state information technology systems, and then all the other efficiencies that come along with that, common architecture across the data center, etc. Then your personnel savings and such and costs associated are definitely a driver as well, but more at risk, I think, were some of the security issues relative to 12 data centers versus one. At any rate, the data center was approved through policy from the governor's office and Department of Administrative Services. It went through the appropriate reviews by the legislature, was funded, and implemented. Now, to this point, I think we need to recognize a couple of things that happened. One, and a good thing that happened, was in August of 2005, Mark Ryer, who is seated to my right, was hired. He is the manager of the data center. He became responsible for that program after all the planning had taken place, or what planning had taken place was reviewed by the legislature and then approved. And I think this is a perfect place to stop a moment and recognize one of the flaws that I identified with the data center planning. And that is, don't hire your project manager last. Hire your program manager up front. Mark started looking at some of the plans that had been drawn up and felt that they were flawed, had grave concern about some of the success of the program, and that those reviews by Mark occurred from August of 2005 up to January 2006, when I became the director of the Department of Administrative Services. In about a three-week period in January, after I was the director and looked at how the project was coming together, I also had concerns about the success of the State Data Center and the Scenic Project under the current planning mechanism that was put in place. I challenged the 12-member governing board as to the plans associated with the data center. We at that time decided it was appropriately decided to refocus some of the plans associated with the data center. We changed the funding base for it. We changed the staffing base for it, identifying errors in the plans that had been previously laid out for the center. We brought those plans forth to the March GLCIMT committee. We then moved forward to the April E-Board General Government Subcommittee and gave them an update as to what we wanted to change in the plans for the data center. those plans were granted at that time, and the biggest change that took place was we increased the staffing levels in order to make the data center successful. We extended the savings that would be accrued from the data center out one biennium. In other words, you won't receive savings from the data center in 09-11 as first promised to you. You will receive those savings in 2011-13. So we moved the accrued savings for the data center out one biennium from what was previously planned and what was told to legislators would be saved. Now, I feel that the data center is going to be successful. I don't have any qualms about it whatsoever. All agencies except for education are currently housed inside the data center. Education has some challenges because there's some question as to whether or not an agency outside of education, like Department of Administrative Services, should be holding data information on students. The challenge is there's a federal law that states, or there's a question as to whether or not federal law applies to DAS not being an education agency, therefore can DAS hold data on students. Where the federal law says education information has to be held by an education agency. We're challenged with that. We're working with both Department of Justice representatives from the state and seeking advice from general counsel at the federal government and Department of Ed at the federal level as to whether or not that can be accomplished. Currently, Mark is taking a look at some of the overriding architecture with respect to consolidating all of the information in the data center into one architect from the 12 agencies. And that kind of gives you a quick overview. I think I should probably also mention, in conjunction with the management review that I gave the data center project and the adjustments that we made in the planning and implementation, at the same time, there was a Secretary of State's audit that was being conducted on the data center, had been going on for about a year and a half. We helped facilitate that audit so we could also learn from the audit about things we might be able to do better. Everything we identified in the management review that we conducted was identified in the Secretary of State's audit. There was also an audit that was done by the legislative branch on the data center, which is pretty much a mirror image of the Secretary of State's audit, pretty much everything that I found in my management review and the plans that we put in place to amend the implementation at the data center. Now, I do want to stress that although your savings from the data center won't be realized for another biennium out, we did not come to the legislature to ask for more money. We were able to manage all of this internally, so we did not come back to E-Board and say we need more money for this or for that. The agencies within the data center manage through their current budgets, and we've not had to come back, and we don't anticipate having to come back to legislature to ask for more funds to bail the data center out. I think it'll stand on its own under the current system we have in place. I think the program will be a success. Is there any questions from you chair or with respect to anything to date or anything from the
anything panel? Do you have any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Garrard.
I got a couple questions. One is the data for the Secretary of State, is that going to be lodged in this?
No.
The data for the Secretary of
State's office?
Is the Secretary of State's office IT housed in the data center?
Yeah.
Chair Riley, Representative Garrard, I'm not aware that it is.
Okay.
Now, are you referring to the audit that was done?
May I? Sure. He's asking, I believe, if the Secretary of State's data that they typically have in the Secretary of State's office, such as election data and that sort of thing, is that part of the data center plan?
Mark, do you have anything from the Secretary of State's elections office in the data center?
Chair Riley and Representative Garrard, no, it's not part of the Scenic 12 as far as consolidation. However, we do some large-scale data processing and have for years, even prior to the consolidation, for the Secretary of State. But as far as election systems, those are still responsibility of Secretary of State.
Okay. Follow-up question. The other question I have is based on security. I'm new to the community, so if you had one agency that kind of has all this power with the computer, how do you, if somebody hacks in, is the information that they're going to be entitled to, is that going to be unlimited? Or, you know, before when you had 12 different agencies, they're at least limited to that one agency if they hacked in. So what's the added security and how does that work?
Chair Riley, Representative Garrard, I'll let Mark respond to that question.
Okay.
Chair Riley and Representative Garrard, members of the committee, my name is Mark Ryer. I'm the administrator of the data center. Representative Garrard, that's always a great question and one that that security analysts are constantly wrestling with. One of the things, it's my belief that under the new architecture, we provide far greater security for the state information and privacy of data, far greater than what was provided before. One of the things to note is that hackers or people that want to hack into this type of data or steal identities or whatever will typically scan all opportunities to get into a state network. And with that, not that I would know, but similar to a car thief, I guess they would check every door of a car in a mall, and the one that's open is the easiest one to steal. But in this particular case, all of our systems are connected on the network. And so in so doing, they'll look for the easiest place to penetrate the state system. And from there, it's very, very difficult to secure the rest of the data from the rest of the agencies. And so what we've done in the state data center is that we have hardened the areas and architected the areas that need the most security. So, for example, there are areas that don't need a lot of security. The public website does not need a tremendous amount of security. On the other hand, there is very, very confidential information, healthcare records, for example, at DHS, that needs extraordinary security. What we've done is we've re-architected so that it's not a one-size-fits-all, that we have hardened layers of security depending on the sensitivity and criticality of the data. The further feature that we've added is 24/7 monitoring. It's really impossible to prevent all hacks. No one has invented the system that is absolutely sure-proof across all technology. But what's important is that you catch attempts as quickly as possible and mitigate the risk. And what we've been able to do in the data center that was not possible in individual agencies is the 24/7 monitoring, so that if we do see a hack attempt or any activity that looks suspicious, We are able to spot it. We get alerts. We're able to get spot it and take whatever corrective or preventative actions, even to the degree that if we have to segment or maybe bring down part of a network so that to prevent access to any kind of critical data. And that typically is what really mitigates the risk of having large-scale hacks or exposures and of privacy or sensitive data.
And, Mark, you've hired some specific experts in security in the data center. Is that not correct?
Representative, I'm sorry, Chairman Riley, that is correct. We have a separate department in the data center that's focused only on security. And that's a good check and balance. We have technical people that manage the networks, technical people that manage the computers, technical people on software and whatnot. It's important to have a separate security department that is overseeing them to make sure that as we, let's say, provision a new computer or add a layer to our network, that it's done according to security standards and will withstand that security checks and no shortcuts are taken. And so we do have a separate department focused just on security.
Can I just one last question?
Sure.
Again, I'm kind of starting out here. What is the problem with how do you deal with viruses and worms? I mean, you know, if somebody has a standard computer at home, you know, that's always a threat. And I know they have a lot of software, but again, as you say, what I would be afraid of is, you know, say a worm got into the, you know, to the state computers and it would take all the computers down. So what sort of safeguards do you put up for that?
Chair Riley and Representative Garrod, members of the committee, there are several safeguards. There's not always there's not the magic bullet that fits all. Those types of attacks are typically the most difficult. Because unbeknownst to any personal computer user, you may have a worm or a virus on your computer now and not know it, and whose sole purpose is to one day wake up when it has access to the network and propagate its maliciousware across the state. We protect our servers and our network with virus protection, spam protection, worms, very evil things called rootkits, that separate from what we have on the desktop. So for every computer that has access to the state, there is virus protection on those personal computers. However, in the event that something gets past those preventative measures, we have another layer that protects our internal computers, our internal network, and our internal data that's on our storage networks. In addition to that, very similar to other security measures, the key to managing viruses or spam is to catch it as quickly as possible. We have one of the luxuries we have actually is being on the West Coast, and so that we're a little bit later. We actually monitor several alerts that come from Department of Defense, agency called CERT, where we do real-time monitoring of alerts that come out for viruses and worms that literally hit the world's networks on a daily basis, several on a daily basis. When we see one that could impact our computers and is severe enough to pay attention to, then we are able to take whatever corrective actions. And again, that's part of the luxury that we have of having 24/7 monitoring. So we're able to do that real-time monitoring for any viruses or worms that that may come out. It's also a benefit, I don't mind telling you, that many of these viruses and worms come from east to west, and so we do have the luxury of seeing the impact that it may have on other systems and before we are able to take action. So, I'm from back east, so it's kind of a luxury that I've noticed out here. And it works.
Thank you. Representative.
Just kind of following up a little bit on what agencies are included and which ones aren't. Which ones are included in this particular project?
The 12, Chair Riley, Representative Thatcher, members of the committee, the 12 agencies that are included would be DAS, And I should add that DAS provided computing services to many, many small agencies that didn't have their own data centers prior, so small boards, et cetera. So that has been consolidated as well. Department of Human Services, Department of Transportation, Department of Revenue, Department of Employment, Department of Corrections, housing, education,
State Police,
DCBS.
And you don't have 12 kids to remember their names.
I have two, and I'd like to forget one. DCBS, Commerce and Business Services, is that DCBS?
Consumer Business Services.
Consumer Business Services, Veterans Affairs.
That's it.
I believe I hit 12.
I have 11.
You have 11?
I had 11.
Yeah, I had 11 too.
Uh-oh. Could I ask you to, you provided a report to the Joint Committee, the last report that you provided. Could you provide that report, copies of that, to the members of this committee?
Chair Riley, that's actually stapled to the back of the presentation here.
Good. And that probably has the 12 in it.
It does.
Chair Riley, that
Forestry. Department of Forestry?
Forestry. Yeah. Hey. Thank you very much. And my apologies to the Department of Forestry.
Chair Riley, that does bring up a question that Mark and I had, and we wanted to ask you what your preference was. In the April e-board meeting, I asked that we be allowed to submit a monthly letter advising JLCIMT and the e-board about the progress with the data center. That has been going on as a routine on a monthly basis since that time, so that JLCIMT and the e-board could see what was taking place inside the data center and that we were on schedule within budget. Now, we didn't know what your choice might be, if you would like to continue to receive those monthly reports from us or not. Before you answer, let me say this. I would like to offer that to you because everything with this data center and the controversy that has surrounded it, we want this to be as transparent to everyone as can be. The reports are a bit of a chore, but I also think it allows everyone the opportunity to take a look inside what's going on with the data center. So with that, the choice is yours. We would certainly provide that to you if you would like.
Well, I think that we should have that. I'd like the committee to have that report.
Okay. We'll make sure that continues on a monthly basis.
Thank you. Any other questions? I had just one question, actually maybe two, but first, about the cost and cost savings that we're having, one of the things that, in my opinion, has not been brought into this is the cost savings of a security breach, and I think that we have I was on the Joint Committee, and so I've seen these reports and heard all this. And one of the things that struck me is, it was, before this came about, much easier to breach the security in a given department. And I think that the cost of a security breach is very large, and I think we've mitigated that to some great degree. And I think we should talk about that when we talk about the cost. And I believe that's an important thing. Education department data. Do you have any idea on a timeline when we might know whether we're going to be able to incorporate that?
Chair Riley, members of the committee, we have talked with the Department of Education, specifically Ed Dennis, on this subject. We would like to have some answers by mid-February, end of February. It may take longer than that, but that's the date that we are trying to get some firm answers back from legal counsel as to the authority in the federal law versus what we want to do here at the state level.
Okay. If there are no other questions, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our next panel is going to tell us about the Owen Project, and we have four folks who are going to talk about that. If you could come up and get a couple more chairs, that'd be great. And and we'll let you all decide in what order you want to go. And
go for so, it, Joe. Thank
yeah,
you, Chair
Joe,
Riley. I think I've been designated as the leadoff.
Okay.
For the record, my name is Joe O'Leary. I'm Governor Kulongoski's Public Safety Policy Advisor, and it's my honor to speak to you today about this very important project. At the 30,000-foot level, members of the committee, what the Owen Project is about is the ability of public safety officials at all levels to be able to communicate with each other, both in their day-to-day operations and in emergency situations. The little-known fact, at least out there to the public, is that that ability to communicate among different public safety agencies does not exist, by and large, right now in the state of Oregon. Statewide, we have four public safety radio systems. Unlike the prior presenters, I only have four children to keep the names the track of, and they're easy. The Department of Transportation, the Oregon State Police, the Oregon Department of Correction, and the Oregon Department of Forestry. Those four systems, for the most part, are dangerously out of date. Some of the infrastructure is over 30 years old. It is so significant that the engineers in charge of maintaining those systems tell me that they have to seek parts to replace broken parts on eBay. And even then, some of those parts are no longer available. This creates a situation where the reality is that our public safety communication system in this state is dangerously out of date and is at risk of failure. The statement I just made, by the way, is almost word for word out of House Bill 2101 from the 2005 session. It was a finding that was made by the 2005 legislature. I appreciate that this is not new news to most of you. The question becomes then, is the state of Oregon going to build four separate public safety radio systems to replace those four state agency systems, four silos that cannot talk to each other, nor could talk to local public safety entities? And House Bill 2101 answers that question, no, we're not going to do that. House Bill 2101 says that we are going to design a unified public safety radio system that has interoperable capability with local public safety agencies, with federal public safety agencies, and with tribal public safety agencies. This is a very important priority for the governor, and what is at stake is bringing communications for public safety into the 21st century. What is at stake is the public safety of Oregonians. What is at stake is the public safety of our first responders, our police, our fire, our search and rescue volunteers, and other professionals. And this is significant both in emergency, whether it be natural disasters, Hurricane Katrina, earthquakes, or man-made disasters, 9/11 and the like, or even in day-to-day operations. I give you a brief example of the day-to-day operation that will really crystallize it for me. There's a gentleman who is working with this program and the dynamic local partnership that Chief Johnson is going to talk to you about in a minute, who is a captain from the Medford Fire Department, who drove up here this morning to Salem to present about Owen to a committee across the street. And he said that as he was driving up, he came across several accidents along the freeway. And he was driving in his Medford Fire patrol car, and he said he had something to the effect of $30,000 worth of communication equipment in that patrol car. And he was out of his home territory. And all of that communication equipment was worthless to him to be able to assist those vehicles that were disabled. So to me, that crystallizes the importance of this, not only in an emergency situation, a disaster situation, but just merely in the day-to-day emergencies where minutes can really mean the difference between life and death. That's the 30,000-foot policy overview of why, what this program is and why we need to move forward. And I'm going to turn it over to these three gentlemen here who are making it happen. Lindsey Ball, who you've heard from already this morning, has been asked by the governor to provide the administrative oversight for this project. Jeff Johnson, who's the chief of Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, is the chair of the State Interoperability Executive Council. That's the body that was created by House Bill 2101, this dynamic partnership of local and state partners. And finally, you'll hear from Mike Zanin with the Oregon State Police, who is the project manager for OWEN. Thank you.
Okay. Before you turn it over, is there any questions for...
Chair Riley, members of the committee, my name is Lindsey Ball. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Administrative Services. In June of last year, I was asked to provide oversight of the OWEN project. And so what we started doing immediately and looking at how we should manage a project of this size was, well, where's the program manager? And we hadn't hired one yet. And so I said, well, one of the first things that we're going to do is we're going to start looking for a program manager to kind of start to bring all the pieces together. And this is, I'm not trying to speak poorly of anyone that was engaged in the project or anything like that. We just simply need to put the infrastructure in place for this to come become a reality and a success. Mike Zanin was hired, sitting on my left here, as the program manager. And he was brought on in September. We went through a process of interviewing and recruiting, etc. And so then Mike stepped forth and started working with a private contractor to come up with a cost estimate associated with the OWEN project. Now, a couple of things I want to kind of clear the air with you. Then this kind of gets to the accountability side of what your charge is. You're going to hear three different numbers about the cost associated with the OWEN project. One is $511 million, which was a calculation that was made by a technical manager as to what he thought before any kind of in-depth review of construction needs or anything else in the state for communications. Then there was another one by Federal Engineering, who was the contractor to take a look at the statewide communication system. That's $905 million. And in consultation with Federal Engineering, by way of the new program manager we'd hired, that price was brought down to $665 million, which is the number that we are currently looking at as the base for the OWEN project. Now, this is where as I stated at an earlier committee today, I've kind of put the brake on things from my shop, in that I want more in-depth analysis done of that cost associated with different parts of the state. The backbone of OWEN, if you will, is going to cost X amount in certain sections. I think we need to break that out so you know exactly what it is you're going to be investing when you say, okay, we're going to spend this money on this piece of the OWEN project to get this benefit for the people of Oregon out of it. We're currently searching for a project analyst to break that down for us and analyze the cost associated with the benefit of those different pieces of the backbone for the OWEN project. Hopefully in the next week or two we will have that person identified and get the person on board so we can start doing some of that detailed analysis work that needs to be done. We will also be able to, at that time, hopefully with some planning, start talking with some potential cost sharing with some of our local governments in the state. And there has also been some question if there can be some public-private agreements reached. But I do caution you that if we start looking at that, That is a large policy issue that we need to carefully review. And that is, do you want to put your public safety communication systems and privatize it, or do you want to hold that as a public resource base? And I think that is a, there are some very, very serious decisions that would have to be made about that. Because the security of our public is very important and actually mentioned constitutionally. So if we move away from that, there needs to be a strong discussion about that, I think. So with that, you're going to see us work through the process and into the Ways and Means hearings of the Oregon State Police probably later, late March, early April. And we hope at that time to have some planning documents for this committee, if you'd like, certainly for Ways and Means, to review before we embark on committing to a project. By the end of session in June, we hope to have more detailed information that the Ways and Means Subcommittee in Public Safety can analyze. I'm not looking at that time, I'm not looking for a full commitment of the $665 million, maybe a portion of it, commensurate with a level of planning that causes you folks to be satisfied that the investment you're making is going to be well spent and a benefit to the people of Oregon. I hope by February of 08, when we come back into session, we'll have a more detailed plan, and we will be underway at that time full speed. Those are some of the checks and the balances that my administrative oversight is working in conjunction with the chief and project manager, Mike Zanin. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Chair Ronnie. The quick question I have is this going to be just focused around the state of Oregon for communications, or is it going to be interwoven with any of the federal agencies?
Chair Riley, Representative Girard, this will also cross lines into the federal arena as well. Okay. This is a partnership that has to make that linkage.
Okay, good. Anything else? Thank you very much.
Chair Riley, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Johnson. I'm the fire chief for Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. We serve 9 cities and 3 counties in the Portland metropolitan area. And I've been a fire chief in Oregon for nearly 29 years, starting originally in the Roseburg area. I am, most importantly for today's purposes, the chair of Oregon's Interoperability Council and have been since its inception in January of 2002. The unique, format of this committee is, and why I say unique, it's unique to the state of Oregon in that it's comprised of 50% local government responders and 50% state agencies that own public safety wireless communication systems. And it has been for its entire duration. And I think a lot of people probably assume that those of us that are responding to fires, medical emergencies, and to police emergencies, we probably have all the capabilities you have with your cell phone, but the reality is we don't. When the bell rings and the call comes, our public safety radio system work as far as our edge of our territory, and then they stop working completely. And they don't even talk to a neighboring response agency unless we happen to be on a common system, which is very unusual, I think, as a pattern. Oregon is layered, as is every state in the country, layered with these umbrellas of radio coverage in which there's no direct linkage between them. It'd be like your cell phone stops working when you leave Beaverton, and if you're in Medford, you can't call anyone that has a cell phone because you're out of your home area. You can only talk in Beaverton to people in Beaverton that have a radio or a cell phone bought for Beaverton. And that's the situation we find ourselves in. As a local responder, of which there's over 20,000 in Oregon, both career and volunteer, as a local responder, the need to communicate with the state resources as they come and aid local responders, or local responders aid the state, or both of us require the assistance of the federal government and their responders, it's absolutely critical, not just in a natural disaster like Rita, Katrina, or a tsunami, but every day in Oregon. And the reality is that doesn't exist. This 50-50 match of local responders and state agencies has really coalesced around this concept of an interoperable network for wireless communications in Oregon, of which local responders can jump onto and talk to state responders, and also to use that to talk to other local responders that they may not otherwise be able to communicate with. This is a tremendous investment, and this is a tremendous opportunity for us to seize in Oregon while we're replacing three of four state systems that must be replaced anyway. And I think for the first time in my career in Oregon, it's the first time I've seen police officers and firefighters brought together to embrace a concept that affects us all, to the tune of, we have the endorsement for this concept by the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association, the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, APCO, the Association of Public Safety Communication Officials, and the League of Oregon Cities. And to bring together that group of local government to support a state initiative, I think is unparalleled in my career, and I think it speaks a lot about the collaborative fashion in which we've crafted this vision. So, Chair Riley, members of the committee, I'll defer any further comments until maybe after Mr. Zanin's comments.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mike Zanin. I'm with the Oregon State Police. I'm the Owen Program Director. I have provided you a handout today, and for the sake of time, and my colleagues have covered many things that are on the first page, and I've tried to underline some things that I'm going to address as I work through my presentation. So if you'd look at page one, I think Joe and Lindsay and the chief did a very good job of talking about the background of how we got to where we got today. What I'd like to give you an appreciation for, hopefully, is some of the strategy that we've employed to date, some of the things that we've done to date to get to where we're at. You'll see there at the bottom of the first page, we've already begun the consolidation. As was mentioned, the four state agencies have built and have separately owned and operated those systems for a number of years. Last year, we consolidated the management of the communication systems for the Oregon State Police and the Oregon Department of Transportation. And so those are co-managed. We're sharing those resources now as we support the communications infrastructure that we have in place today. Federal engineering, it's not a federal government organization. It is the consultant that we hired through a competitive procurement process last February to come in and say, tell us what we need to do. How big is this thing? How much are we talking about spending? And just a note there, they were hired through a competitive procurement process. They're top shelf organization that do this kind of work across the nation and local governments and other state governments. They are precluded from bidding on the actual design and build of the system, so they don't have any inherent conflict of interest to bump the numbers way up because they're not going to be in the game for the actual design build. So we tried to structure some integrity in the front end of the process so what they gave us was something that we could actually run with. We're continuing to formalize partnerships and cost-sharing agreements that will become part of the Owens system. Time probably doesn't permit me to tell you about some of the great partnerships we have going on right now with federal government and with local governments where we're putting in infrastructure. The feds are funding it. We're going to manage it and own it and operate it, and they get to use it. In local cases, they're putting in a building. We're putting in a tower, and we see that kind of work continuing. We've been able to get some federal grant funds to get the planning underway to date. A lot of the planning that we've done, the staff that we've hired, have been funded using federal funds to date. A handful of us went back to Washington, D.C. in early December to meet with our congressional delegation to try to keep Oregon on the radar screen as far as getting in the stream of federal funds to try to leverage the dollars that are being made available out of Washington, D.C. for interoperability type projects. So we've gone out there, we've made the presentation, we've tried to position Oregon as being ready to go to make good use of federal funds. On the second page, in the middle there, under the cost estimate category, you see it broken up into three phases. This is a phased approach, roughly corresponding with the 07-09 biennium, 9-11 biennium, and the 11-13 biennium. You can see the locations and the totals for each phase. The estimated cost at this point in time, again, this is for a conceptual design, is $665 million. And again, I want to underscore that this is a cost estimate for conceptual design. Some key points to remember: the next step is we're going to actually put this out to bid. We're going to put together a competitive procurement process where we take the requirements that the state has and the conceptual design and solicit bids from the vendor community, say, what would you charge to come in and do the detailed design and build? We don't have those numbers yet. We're hoping that that competition will lead to some cost reductions. The other thing that this doesn't reflect in the 665 is the partnerships that have been previously mentioned. To date, we partner whenever we put in infrastructure. Today, we're partnering when we put in infrastructure, and I have every reason to believe we're going to continue to do that as we put in infrastructure. I've met with the Coast Guard, the BLM, the Forest Service, folks in Central Oregon, folks in Southern Oregon, where I'm going up tomorrow to meet with folks from the Portland metro area to talk about partnerships as we build this thing out. I can tell you, I believe that's going to lead to some cost reductions. The challenge that I have, if you say, well, how much, I can't tell you that today because we haven't inked those partnerships. We're not there yet. But everybody I talk to is basically saying the same thing. Listen, when you get ready to build infrastructure in my area, let's talk because we need to upgrade our systems too. So to the extent that we can share buildings, towers, that kind of thing, I'm encouraged by. At the end of the day, what do we get when the Owen system is complete? At the bottom of page 2 there, we have a consolidated state agency public safety emergency response communication system. We have the first ever statewide public safety mobile data capability. This would allow emergency workers to have laptops, mobile data terminals in their cars to be able to access information that they need. Some local governments have that now, but on a statewide basis, it's not available.
Can I ask a question just for clarification? First ever statewide for Oregon or first ever statewide nationally?
Oregon. Okay. We have a statewide interoperable public safety communications backbone that can be used by all public safety agencies day-to-day and during emergencies. Greatly increased reliability over the current systems. I'd love to take you to some of our sites to show you what we're dealing with today. You would be amazed. They are in great need of update. We have a scalable communication system that can take advantage of new technologies. The design that we've come up with and that we're going to put out a bid for does not paint us into a corner. There's some promising emerging technologies out there that we're keeping our eye on. And this design is scalable. As we add users, we can add capacity. And as new technologies come out, we can bolt on new technologies to that infrastructure. And then finally, it meets the FCC guidelines for narrow banding. That's a requirement by the Federal Communication Commission that requires all public safety agencies to move to a new technology that makes better use of the radio spectrum by the end of 2012. Finally, I guess I'd leave you with this at the top of page 3. This is fundamentally about doing what's right for Oregon citizens and public safety professionals. Owen will maximize the value and the use of shared investments, not only within the Owen system, but across the state. Oregon is ideally positioned to move forward. We are benefiting right now from 5 years of planning. This wasn't some idea that was just recently hatched. The State Interoperability Council has been meeting since 2002, multi-governmental, multidisciplinary group of people that have been, wrestling through this to come up with where we're at today. And as the chief mentioned, we have endorsements from a number of those professional groups. We need to work together to address the challenging policy issues related to governance, finance, and procurement. I have to tell you, those three issues right there when I think about them long enough, my head hurts. There are some thorny policy issues ahead as we roll this thing out. The technology is one thing, and I don't want to say it's easy, but it may be the easiest part of all this. When you start talking about governance of this system, when you talk about financing long-term of this system, and you start talking about the procurement that we were faced with, there are some real complexities and challenges there. This is a complex, expensive undertaking that requires a long-term commitment, but we have to start now. It's all about saving lives. It really is. It's not just a dramatic statement. It's true. This is about saving lives. As is mentioned, sometimes minutes can make the difference. It's an investment that we absolutely have to make, and we've got to get started now because status quo is not an option. With that, I'd invite any questions that you might have.
As I was, thank you, Mr. Chair. As I was looking under your phasing, I was kind of curious how this was decided. What,
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, that's a great question. There's a couple of reasons why we looked at doing eastern, northeastern Oregon first. Number one, the level of complexity there, as far as the number of systems that you'd have to intertie with, and even the number of users is considerably less than it is, say, within the Willamette Valley. So in some ways, we'd like to, frankly, walk before we run. This is going to be new technology to a lot of the people that are going to have to manage it. And to the extent that there's going to be bumps along the way, we would rather do that in a less populated area than right in the core populated area of Oregon. That's one reason. Two, again, candidly speaking, there is a concern amongst a lot of people that if the Willamette Valley gets the funding and we get started and then there's we lose motivation, we lose heart, we lose funding, well, we got most of the people covered. The rest of the state, just have to get by. And we didn't want to do that. And so there was a conscious decision made through the State Interoperability Council that as we develop these phases, that we do so for those two reasons. And, Chief, I don't know. I know you've been involved in some of those discussions. Have you had anything to add to that?
The only thing I'd add to that, Representative, is that the metropolitan area where the majority of the population lives, as we know, it enjoys a much higher level of interoperability today and therefore can wait a little longer to create a system like this. So those were the three factors that weighed in the recommendation.
Thank you.
Chair, Representative.
Thank you, Chair. Two questions. First, how many other states are ahead of us in this process, and have you looked to them for guidance, what for snags and what's worked really well, et cetera?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, I don't have an exact answer for it. I can give you an estimate. There are 30 other states. I was on a conference call with some folks from the federal government about 2 months ago, and this is my source of information, so take it for what it is. But the people that were facilitating this conference call have their finger on the pulse of what's going on from an interoperability standpoint around the nation. And they mentioned that there were 30 state interoperability executive councils, kind of like Oregon has. And so I can tell you there are at least 30 other states that are talking about this. I can tell you because I've visited some of the states and I've done research on some of the states, Oregon is certainly not first. We're probably in the middle of the pack, to be honest with you, as far as rolling these systems out. To the extent that we can learn, we're trying to do that. There's actually a 50-state invite to Los Angeles in March with all the states talking about interoperability planning, trying to get representatives from all 50 states that we're going to go down and participate in. That should give us a lot more information. The challenge that we've had is we haven't found a single source that kind of tracks who's doing what have they learned, and so we find out stuff just as we dialogue with some of our colleagues and peers from around the nation. I could begin to tell you anecdotally what other states are spending, but it's not an apples-to-apples comparison. Part of the challenge is Oregon's current infrastructure is so far behind the curve, and again, this is you'd have to see it to believe it. We are so far behind that just to get up to where other states are at today is a fairly significant investment. Our consultants have said that we have to replace about 80% of our infrastructure just to get it to a point of acceptability. When I say infrastructure, I'm talking about buildings and towers and just the microwave system that transport the voice signals around the state. State of New York, for instance, is spending $2 billion on their statewide interoperable system. Not necessarily an apples-to-apples comparison. They have a lot more users than Oregon has, but Oregon has a lot more geography than they have. And we're the ninth largest state. And, you know, they're going to spend $2 billion over the course of the next 6 to 8 years, and that's a significant, significant investment. But most states don't have the geography that Oregon has with the Coast Range and the Cascades and the Wallowas and the Blues and the Strawberries and the Steens. All of that adds to the cost because you got to put up more towers to get the signal into places that folks need to be.
Rhode Island's had a statewide system for years.
Chair Riley, if I may supplement to just add one piece of information to Representative Edwards' question, and I want you to be aware too that the National Governors Association has been very active, and actually it's the NGA who is hosting the conference that Mr. Zainan referenced in Los Angeles coming up in March of all 50 states to talk about where they are all at in their interoperable communications plan, and the NGA has published best practices to date. And what I want to tell you is that the groundwork that these folks have laid with the State Executive Interoperability Council and these other efforts has all been consistent with all of those best practices that have been published by the National Governors Association. So qualitatively, I think that we are very much on track and going in the right direction and are consistent with the best practices to the extent we know them right now.
Mr. Chair, appropriate ground. Mr. Zainan. The question I would have is, it was brought to our attention that you expect some cost sharing and you had the endorsement of the League of Oregon Cities. The question is, how much are you expecting to get from local government to pick up on this price tag, and how much is the state going to have to pick up on this price tag?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Garrod, I don't know. As far as what kind of funding we're going to get from local governments, that is unknown. All I can tell you is that as we have met with local government folks who support communication, public safety communication systems at the local and the state level, everybody is saying the same thing. We want to share the cost where we can. When are you going to be investing? When are you going to be in our area? And then let's talk. That's number one. And I guess the other thing, the challenge that we face is just trying to time it with when they need to make an investment. We know that the Portland area has, folks have told me that they've got to make about a $70 million investment in their communication system in the next 3 years. So trying to time when we do building and they're doing building so as to maximize that shared investment is something that is yet to be seen. So my honest answer is I can't tell you that today. We have designed a system that is robust enough that if a local government, this is one thing that's worth noting, if a local government had to update their system and they decided, well, listen, we've got this thing called Owen land right over the top of us. Why don't we just become subscribers to the Owen system? We're going to have in place the capability and a rate model that would allow local governments to join and become subscribers to where they actually become full-time users of the Owen system. And the system design that we have in place today, again, as I mentioned, is going to be robust enough to enable that, although we certainly can't mandate that at this point in time.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Representative Edwards.
One more question regarding new technologies. In your notes, you'd mentioned that these budget projections do not account for potential reductions due to emerging technologies, and I know oftentimes the case is that emerging technologies actually cost more. So maybe you could speak a little bit to that, and are the technologies that you're looking at tested? We've had, I know, down near my district and partly in my district, We have a local transit district that went with some great emerging technology for a whole bus system, and a few years later, it doesn't work. It doesn't work, and they had to scrap the whole thing. So I would like to encourage that we're talking about tested technologies, and hence my previous question about what other states are doing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, it's actually refreshing to get your question, because more often than not, we're being driven to look at newer emerging technologies, and we've actually gotten some, you know, concerns about even the technologies that are embedded in the conceptual design. The RFP that we put out is going to be based on proven standards-based technology. The federal government has a standard called Project 25 for radio communication systems that allow interoperability between various vendors' products. That's going to be a baseline standard, is the Project 25 standard. There are technologies out there related to, you know, wide area. It's called WiMAX. It's kind of like Wi-Fi in your home, only on steroids, and it goes a lot further. There's some emerging technologies in the WiFax arena that we're keeping an eye on. It's not necessarily going to be an initial part of the bid, but we're going to look at ways that we may be able to bolt that on at a later point in time, because it can provide some added functionality for fairly reasonable costs. And then just with software design radios and with intelligent radios, there are some technologies that are on the horizon out there that we're keeping our eye on that may be able to provide some additional functionality as the cost of that comes down, as long as it still continues to meet the standards and the baseline requirements for interoperability and reliability. We're watching it. We're not going to be the first to embrace new technologies. I can guarantee that. We're going to use proven technologies, and that's what the conceptual design has in place today. But we don't want to become so focused on that we lose sight of what's coming down the road.
Thank you.
Well, if there are no other questions, thank you for your testimony. I want to express my gratitude for the work that you gentlemen are doing, and Director Ball for his oversight and the work that he's done with you, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, with that, we're going to adjourn the committee, and thank you very much.